gentlemen on the rail at a jog. Please on the rail at a jog.
Hello, everyone. We're back with another episode of On the Rail podcast. With it being breeding season, we did feel like it would be a great topic to discuss again. And of course, we had one of our favorite guests on, Miss Chelsea Sinclair is back. And so without further ado, I'll let her reintroduce herself and then we'll go from there.
Hello, Chelsea Sinclair. I am an AQHA and APHA competitor and breeder as far as personal life and then professional life. I am a breeding manager. I work with everything from quarter horses and paint horses to warm blood, even some ponies and draft mixes in the past as well, but primarily focusing on quarter horses, paint horses, and warm blood.
Susie, if you want to introduce yourself for us.
Hi there. This is Susie Phillips, and I live in Bernie, Texas, and I am an amateur owner of a stallion called Unbridle Your Dreams, and I'll call you later. And I have Coraval Ranch that is in Bernie, Texas, along with two partners, Ben and Julie Wolf. And I've been in the industry since I was 12 years old, showing horses and competitively, hunter under saddle, and now a new stallion owner.
Thank you, gals, for joining us today. There's a million different topics that you could ever try to figure out where to go with breeding subjects. And we had a request from one of our listeners to maybe dive into the stallion side a little bit more and just owning a stallion ownership and all that it entails and things that we maybe don't know for people that don't own stallions and everything about it. So that's kind of going to be the direction of the podcast today. But before we get really deep into that, can you both maybe share with us what your early involvements and kind of career paths have been with the breeding side of things?
So I kind of accidentally got into stallion ownership when I was like, I don't know, 10 or 11 years old. There was a horse I was in love with. My grandma bought it for me. Turns out he was the bilateral crypt orchid.
Oh, no. Did you think he was a gelding when you bought him then?
Yes, actually. Okay. And so he had come off the track, and sadly enough, they had actually like cut him to make it look like he had been gelded. But he had very stallion-like behaviors. He was a jerk. We'll just put it that way. You know, and just did the typical stallion-y kind of things. And anyway, he was gelded and, you know, went on to be a very nice youth horse for me in the regular kind of youth F hunters. That's kind of how I accidentally got involved with it. From a professional standpoint, I actually went to Clemson University to get my undergrad in animal science. I'm focusing on equine business. I wanted to go manage a hunter jumper facility was my goal. And then in the meantime, while I was there, I took the breeding and polling practicum, which you had to be pretty dedicated to do because it was every Monday, Wednesday, Friday at 6 a.m. And you had full watch, you know, so took that class, really got into it, went on to manage that hunter facility, but really, really missed the breeding aspect of things. So I went to grad school at Kansas State University for equine reproduction. I got my master's and my PhD there. And that's kind of how I fell deeper into the rabbit hole of breeding.
I started out, my first experience in like stallion ownership and mares was with my next door neighbor who his name was Vince Catino, and he owned a stallion called Impressive Bear. And it was a paint stallion, the Tip Top's Hancock, which was another, he was a black and white Overa stallion. And so he kind of took a liking to me, and he was my dad's best friend. And so I just was underneath his wing and, you know, watched them as they, you know, bred mares and how they pick and choose what mares they were going to breed. And then that kind of led me to 4-H horse judging. And that the horse judging led me to Cloudcroft, where at that point, Shad's Prescription and Zippo Pine Bar were standing. And, you know, Zippo Pine Bar, he's a legend. Mm-hmm. And it was really, really cool at such a young age for me to see him. He was fairly old. I think he was like 22 years old when I saw him, but he was still breeding several mares a year. And his, I think his breeding fee was like 10 grand or something crazy like that. And that was when I was like 19, and now I'm 50. So, you know, that's been a while, been a minute. And that just kind of led me, my passion for the mayor side for a while. And my dad and myself and my mom, we went together and bought a couple of mayors and bought some from Tim and Lou Petty down in Florida when they were hot and heavy. I have one mayor that has Carol Harris's name on the paper that I still own. That was the breeder, you know. And so that kind of led me down the path of ownership of mayors. And then in the last couple of years, my partners and I, we had the opportunity to purchase two really nice stallions from Dale Livingston and pretty much his entire breeding program, you know, that he had spent years making great examples of babies and yearlings and did really well with it. And we purchased I'm a Platinum Dream and Unbridle Your Dream. And I'm a Platinum Dream at that time had he had a lifetime earnings for his get like 82,000, and his full crop was not very big. And we were kind of excited about him. And then the junior sire, Unbridle Your Dreams, he hadn't shown very much, but man, he just had exemplary temperament and confirmation and very trainable. And we were excited about promoting him and putting him on the road. So that was, you know, that was quite the adventure 2 years ago, I guess now, that we purchased him. And since then we've lost I'm a Platinum Dream. He got hurt in a breeding accident and, you know, we had to lay him to rest. But now we have I'll Call You Later, which is an Allocate Your Asset stud out of Jazz in the Park, and Rodular Jeans, which AKA his name is Special. And so we're standing them. Well, not standing the I'll Call You Later, but we are standing the Unbridle Your Dreams this year at Mike Hayes.
I definitely want to dive into the stallions or stallion that both of you guys own. But one quick question before we do that is, I know you guys have both had pretty monumental changes in your life recently, and Chelsea changing career paths, and Susie, your whole unveiling of Corville Ranch. So let's just touch on both of those things real quick, because I know those are going to be questions people are wondering before we even talk about the stallions.
Sure. You know, it definitely is a career change for me in terms of academia to industry. However, the industry side of equine reproduction, I was already doing in academia, so at least it's not like a total 180. You know, the parameters and the housing of it is a lot different between academia and industry. You know, and it's definitely a big change. It's nice to get to work with a variety of studs. We definitely worked with a lot of different studs at Kansas State, but at Clemson, we primarily just worked with our resident stallions and a few outside stallions here and there. So you got to know them really well. But what I really like about breeding management, especially on the stallion side, is, you know, stallions are, everybody gives mares the bad rap for being sensitive. Stallions are way more sensitive. And they're just very particular. They very much thrive with a routine, and it takes quite a bit of homework on the front side, really getting them figured out and figuring out what they need from you to be able to be at their best in that breeding shed. We definitely want things to be as efficient as possible for obvious reasons, but primarily for the stallion, you know, so that's where I find a lot of enjoyment, is that challenge and kind of figuring out each individual and what best suits them, not just on the collection side of it, but even on the backside in terms of processing. There's about a million different ways we can process semen at this point, and each stallion semen is going to be different from the next in terms of how it handles those processing steps. Some of them do better with the seminal plasma centrifuge off. Some of them can't tolerate the centrifugation process. Figuring out different extenders, things like that, that, you know, work best for them. It's all kind of, that's the challenge of it, really. So that's kind of the fun part for me, getting to figure all that out and getting to know each individual very well.
For any of our listeners that don't know, Chelsea left Clemson University and recently took over I don't know what your official title is for Hassinger's.
The breeding and stallion manager, and then also kind of manager, if you will, of the Equine Reproduction Center.
Okay. Yeah. Someone to be clear about that part. And Susie, you want to talk about your grand news in the last year or so?
Well, it's been quite an exciting year. We opened a equine rehab facility in Boerne, Texas. It's a 47-acre facility. We are in the process of building a breeding lab and mare and stallion station, and that's hopes to be completed here in the next little bit, at least for next breeding season. So, and then we have the Dr. David Dutton, who also works at Lubbock at Texas Tech. He is the veterinarian that's going to be doing surgeries out of our facility. So we have a surgery room and two knockdown rooms. So kind of exciting. So that we unveiled that in October was a grand opening for our facility. And when prior to that, you know, obviously we bought 32 horses from Dale Livingston, and we also bought a mare from Amy Hassinger last year as a yearling on my 50th birthday. And, you know, we showed her at the Congress this year, and we had a great, great year with her. So it's just been a really exciting year opening up the ranch and getting the rehab facility up and running and the equestrian center up and running and getting the build completed for our breeding center.
So much going on for both of you.
A lot.
Yeah. I can't even imagine. Talk about the stallions you both own and what it's like maybe from a owner perspective versus a stallion manager perspective, if you can separate those two things.
For sure. So my personal stallion is no doubt this is Pot. He's a double registered AQHA, APHA stallion by No Doubt Absolute out of Hoping for Hot Iron, who's the These Are Injure Hot daughter. He won multiple world champion titles, reserve world champion, lots of bronze titles, been top 5 and top 10 at the Quarter Horse Congress several times. Just a really, really solid horse that loves his job. He loves the undersaddle. He loves the hunter hacks, our favorite class. And we also do the working hunter and the equitation over fences, and he does the derbies as well. Really nice amateur friendly mount. So that's my personal stallion. I also stand Figured I'm Invited. He is also a double registered stallion. Been through a lot of great programs, and he's retired to be a breeding horse now. And he's just a really cool horse. He's by invitation only out of the great mare Go Figure, who is the daughter of Charlie Hilfiger. She's a great performer and producer. I love, love, love his bottom side. And of course, invitation only on the top is wonderful as well. And so the Hassingers own him now. And then they also have their two warm blood stallions, Caduceusy and Gersandro. Those two are down in Wellington right now. The warm bloods don't really get going in the breeding shed until April. So it's kind of nice to have a soft start, if you will, with the quarter horse boys.
I have Special, which is Unbridled Your Dreams. He is standing at Mike and Jan Hayes at Pilot Knob Stallion Station there in Florida this year. He stood there last year. He's a junior stallion. He is just the best-minded dude. And when I saw him, I fell in love with him. He is the epitome of great confirmation. Stands up in his wither, and he puts a big old hawk on his babies. Really just excited about him and what our plan is for him continuing to show him. I guess not a lot of people are showing their stallions, you know, once they take them to the breeding shed, a lot of them are just breeding. And I think the difference, you know, that between Chelsea and I is that we actually take our stallions out and we still show them. And that way they're still in the public and people can meet them and see them and, you know, show just how exemplary that they are. And then I own the I'll Call You Later. He is a bay stallion that's double papered. And he's super cool. We were going to stand him this year, but Two Fox Farms, Tyler and Robert, just feel super excited about him and their plan for running for Super Horse this year with him. So we kind of pulled back on the standing him this year and plan on continuing to show him to get more accolades for him. He is a world and reserve world champion at the APHA World Show. So he's got some titles that we're super excited about him. The last few shows that Robert and Tyler took him to, Quad has been the open junior horse circuit champion, or actually High Point champion. So that's been kind of exciting. So two horse shows in a row, with Two Fox Forums, and we've been pretty successful with him. So
cool.
I just love the boys. You know, when I first saw him, you know, I just fell in love with him. So.
Well, and kind of along those lines, talking about Claude, he was actually going to come stand with us up here in North Carolina. When you talk about, you know, being a stallion owner, stallion manager, breeding manager, what have you, you know, these are all things to factor in there, because I was down in Florida with my stud and Susie and her stud, and just watching him in the pen, and he's really hitting a stride, you know, in the new event that he's doing. And you kind of have to make that decision, not only Susie as his owner, but me, you know, in terms of the breeding manager side of things, supporting that decision when you see a horse really hitting a stride in a new event. Kind of the last thing you really want to do is pull him out of that, especially when you want to make a run like they're planning on with him this year. You kind of have to just weigh that cost-benefit analysis, you know, so to speak, there. And I think that's a great decision for him. Just let him focus on those big goals that they've got this year and let him come in strong. And there's a breeding horse.
Yeah, and it was a really tough decision. You know, we sat down, Ben and Julie and I, we sat down and had a meeting about it. And financially, it would be great to be having the income of all the breeding fees. But for the horse's career in the long haul, he is young. It just seemed to be the right choice to make for him, especially as well as he has done at the last several horse shows. And I feel like Tyler and Robert really have a great plan for him for the year. And we're really excited to see what they accomplish with him and to meet the goals that they've set for him.
Since you guys both have stallions that still show, do you have already an anticipated end date for their show careers? Or is it your intentions right now to just show them as long as they continue to enjoy it and last? Or have you even thought about that long-term plan with your stallions?
Well, we've discussed the long-term plan. I've discussed it in length with Chelsea. I've discussed it in length with Stephanie or Melanie and Scott Jones and all of them on what our goals should be. And we've all decided that as long as the horses are enjoying their job and they are manageable and are, you know, we don't have any complications that arise with them as far as in the breeding shed, we plan to continue to show them. I just think that it makes them more personable and more tangible for the mare owner to see them. You know, it's one thing to see a horse in a magazine or on social media, and then it's one thing to see them in person and in the flesh. And they're just so much more impressive in the flesh, if that makes sense.
I'll agree with that, you know, on mine as well. I mean, mine, my amateur horse. So hopefully he wants to continue showing. And my horse, I did decide to give him a little bit of a break last breeding season, coming off of a really long, really strenuous show season. I wanted him to not get burnt out, not to personify horses or anything like that. But I mean, there was like resentment there from his during the break. He was like, this is stupid. I'm bored, you know. And just wasn't really super happy kind of having that vacation, if you will, which told me that he still wants to go and do. And I think, you know, even after we kind of get to a point where we're not pushing so hard on the show end of things, we might do some other things that I have interest in from like my childhood riding experiences, like hunter paces, fox hunting, something. I don't think he's going to be a horse that's happy being retired just stud anytime in the foreseeable future. Now, obviously, you have to, you know, listen to the horse. But like I said, for me, he's also, you know, my sole amateur mount at the moment. So he's kind of pulling triple duty.
So for you guys, it seems like out of the norm for you guys to continue showing your stallions, which I think is awesome. And I totally agree with both your points that you had. Is, and I don't know if you can answer this, but is it more normal then for the stallions once they hit the breeding shed to be done showing? Or what, I guess, is the main reason why we don't continue seeing more stallions in the pen?
So I can answer this question for you. Couple of other stallion owners that I've spoke with in the past is, you know, when they have say, for instance, they take a stallion and he goes and wins the world show. You know, their thought process behind that, from who I've spoken to, they chose to send them to the breeding shed and not getting them beat anymore. And then everybody thinks about it, or all the mare owners think about it, as the horse left the industry, the show industry part of it, and went to the breeding shed on top. I, as an amateur owner, feel that it's more important to see a horse still down the road, doing its job, loving its job. And yeah, it's great to go and win in, you know, the Congress or the World Show and all that. That's great. But that's, you know, that's hard. It's hard to do, and it's hard to keep that pace. And it's exciting when it happens. But I just think, I really think that the amateur owner or amateur mare owner, which I was previous to this, I want to be able to see that horse and see what its demeanor is in public, and that it can hold up conformationally to showing and going to the breeding barn. And I mean, I think there comes a point in time where the horse is worth more in the breeding shed than he is showing. And you know, that's, you have to weigh that balance when it's time. But a lot of young stallion owners whose horses have gone and won and done really, really well want to leave the show part with the horse on top and then move to the breeding shed. I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, and I'll kind of add on to that, you know, a little bit of a difference too is Dizzy and I stallions, they are more, they do the all around events, you know, whether it's the, you know, more hunt seat stuff, more Western stuff, what have you. But, you know, for a rail horse, you know, there's just not a ton of emphasis on the senior Western pleasure or the senior hunter under saddle. So once you kind of get through those maturity years and those junior years, the kind of interest, I don't want to say interest because that's not really the word I'm looking for, but the value of a win decreases in an aged horse. So you have one of those horses that's coming off of an extremely successful 2 or 3 year old year, and they've got a heavy book, you know, it makes sense to let them kind of focus on being a breeding horse. The other thing is, sometimes I think inherently I take for granted a little bit, but we always joke around about it being hard work being a stallion. It actually is. And so it kind of takes a special horse that can really hold up being both a breeding horse and a show horse. It's physically demanding. It's definitely mentally demanding for that horse to be able to switch gears like that. So sometimes it's easier to just let them go one way or the other. And I don't think either way is right or wrong necessarily. I do think it is nice when you see a horse that, you know, out there adding events and continuing to show. That tells me he's got to be pretty good minded, realistically. You know, so I definitely appreciate that in a horse. I don't think there's per se a right or wrong answer. And it depends on the side of the industry you're on too. A farrier of mine who's very near and dear to my heart, he's a roper, and he shod Willie for the first all the way up through April of this year from his first set of shoes on. And after the second year we went to the World Show, you know, he was like, what more does the horse have to do before you retire him to stud? Because in the rope horse world, I mean, stud goes out there and wins the world title, he's done. He's in the breeding shed now. And that's kind of their mentality in that side of it. Or a lot of them anyway. It just depends, I think.
You know, if you look at the perspective of what Chelsea and I are trying to do with our stallions, is we are trying to build, like she said, all-around producers. So if you look at the industry and where it's going, it's very specialized. And what we're trying to do is break the mold. We're trying to go back to that horse that can go and do the hunter under saddle and the trail and the Western riding, and then can go show in the horsemanship and the equitation or the over fences or pull a cart. It takes a while to build that animal. And I think that, you know, with the stallion prospects that we have, we're, you know, we've got a pretty good start at it. Like, I'll call you later. He does the over fences, the hunter under saddle. He pulls cart. I'm now showing him in the amateur working hunter under saddle. He's showing in the performance stallions. And then you take on Unbridled Dreams. He shows in a hunter under saddle. He also shows in the trail. We're adding the Western riding this year. He did the ranch trail and the pole bending at the Congress. So, you know, it's kind of exciting to watch the evolution of our breeding industry and where the performance aspect of things, what direction they're heading. And from, you know, being a part of the, you know, the amateur blog and on Facebook, it sounds like people want to show the horses more than one class. And it's Chelsea and I are trying to, you know, provide that along with several other, you know, breeders in the industry that are awesome. You know, they're doing the same thing, but, you know, it just takes a long time to build that, to build street cred.
Yeah. Well, really build that horse too, that can do those multiple events. Just as a comparison, you know, to throw that out there on the warm blood side of things. I mean, Jim Dud is 17 years old and still out there cracking in the International Hunter Derby. The warm blood side of things, they typically continue to show the horse, whether it's dressage, show jumpers, hunters, you know. And to me, for one reason or another, that could be a whole separate podcast on longevity. But to me, I like to see that model, you know, those horses still out there competing into their mid to upper teens. That shows me that that horse has soundness. He has longevity. He has, you know, in theory, the potential to pass that on to his offspring, too. I think that's a valuable side of it. And like I said, I can understand the viewpoint of retiring them after the futurity years as well, because, you know, the other side of that is we run the risk continuing to work and compete and travel with our horses of something happening. And that's a risk, you know, we have to take with any performance horse, but in a stallion even more so, because you typically have a lot invested into him. And then if he gets hurt, maybe to the point where he can't be a breeding horse even, that's a risk you take when you continue to compete him. But on the same breath, they could just as easily have an injury like that out in the field being retired to stud. So, you know, that's kind of another part of it too.
I've been scribbling notes listening to both of you talk, and I think you're both really spot on. I think there's two separate goals in the industry. Well, there's a lot, but we'll break it down to two for today. kind of like the business of horses and then the amateur side of things. And neither one is wrong. Like Chelsea said, or, you know, like if the stallion's going to get retired right after it wins a bunch of young titles, I can understand that, like she said. But I also completely understand the side of you guys wanting to prove that these horses last and have longevity and good minds. And honestly, as an amateur, I'm an amateur myself, of course, so I'm speaking from an amateur viewpoint here, but I absolutely don't discredit a stallion that maybe had a lot of success even as a young horse, but as it gets older, has less success potentially in the rail classes because maybe its legs aren't as clean as it gets. But the fact that it's out there showing and does have the longevity and shows that it can handle the mindset that is required to do that, that speaks a lot to me. And mm-hmm. I think there's a lot. And I would never, you know, like decide because such and such stallion won the junior Western Pleasure 100 under saddle. And then as a senior horse, you know, couldn't even be in the top three or five. I mean, to me, that's kind of ridiculous anymore. But my last little point on all of this is that while the business of horses will always continue being the business of horses, I feel like most of the time the amateurs are paying the bills for a lot of these horses. So I do personally see the industry going towards what do the amateurs want? Because otherwise, I think if we don't keep the amateurs happy, I don't know who's going to be doing all this stuff. Anyway, one question I did have for you guys, what are the challenges with managing horses or stallions, though, that are showing and breeding potentially at the same time? Like, how do you guys with your own stallions handle the breeding barn and the show schedule all in the same 6 months?
Well, it's tough, I will tell you. If you're trying to get a horse qualified for the world show and you only have so many months to get it done, you really have to pack a punch. And my partners and I were really big on budgeting and making sure that we stay on track with our budget. And so we sit down and speak with our horse trainers, and we're very diligent on what is realistic for that horse to accomplish. And also what kind of money is it going to take to get that horse to the end of the year from the breeding shed, getting it back on the road and then off the road and then back to the breeding shed. So It's a lot of finances and a lot of good time management and a lot of good communication between your horse trainer and your breed manager. Super important that it's a team effort and everyone communicates well.
Yeah, I 100% agree with what Susie said there. And it's tough. I mean, like I said, I gave Willie 6 months off through the breeding season totally this past year. So the first show we did of the qualifying period was the Congress. So for us, trying to get qualified for this next world show is definitely a challenge. Fortunately, there's the Florida circuits over the winter that we took advantage of. So you just really have to be creative with your show schedule. It's not to say, you know, before I took this position here at Hassinger with Willie, I'm blessed in the sense that if I need to collect him Friday morning to ship and put him on a horse trailer and go show Friday afternoon, he can do it. That's not an issue for him. But now I have other stallions, so I can't, you know, before it was like, okay, if we miss a day, as long as I communicate that ahead of time and make sure we're not messing up anybody's breeding plans, we can sneak away for, you know, a three or four day horse show. But now I have other stallions too. So being gone Monday, Wednesday, or Friday is not optional. So we have to get creative with our show schedule there, you know, and just get in where we can kind of. And if we don't make that half a point, then we don't make it. You know, it's at the end of the day, you know, for me, my horse's primary job this time of year is to serve the contract that he has. And my secondary obligation is to myself and my show goals for him. So I think you kind of have to balance that and be a little bit unselfish. And that's not to say it's impossible for a stud to show during season. I just, from a stallion manager's perspective, my kind of the way I look at it is it's okay if he's going to miss a couple of days, but that needs to be communicated well ahead of time, not, you know, somebody put $500 into this mare's cycle to get her ready to breed. And then you stay 24 hours in advance. Oh, we're taking him to a horse show. I think, you know, there's planning involved there and you kind of have to give people a heads up. There's plenty of reigning studs, especially the junior ones that compete through the breeding season, but it's well understood and communicated that, hey, FYI, in 3 months, he's not going to be available on these days, that kind of thing. And I think, you know, for Susie, it's an even added layer because, you know, Willie stays at home with me and for better or for worse, I'm, you know, his day-to-day rider. I'm also his breeding manager, which is nice that it kind of all happens under one roof, so to speak. And then we obviously have our trainers that help us in the meantime, but his day-to-day is just up to me. We don't kind of have that added layer, so to speak. So it's a little bit easier in a sense to kind of manage his schedule in that way.
Should we dive into some of the financial aspects of owning and managing the stallion? Give
Absolutely.
Us the tea on that.
Long and short of it, if you like money.
Don't own horses, period, probably.
Yeah, don't own horses, period. Definitely don't own a stallion. So in terms of the financial aspect, it's hard. And there's a lot of costs that I think, you know, your average horse person wouldn't think about in terms of having the stud, because obviously their care and cost are roughly the same as any other kind of show horse. But what you kind of maybe don't necessarily think about is the fact that, you know, there are all these programs that they have to be put into that costs either money or a donated breeding or both. And then you've got the advertising piece of it. And for Susie and I, we still have their cost of being an upper level show horse. So we have, you know, the regular show horse cost as well. And then on top of it, if you're sending your stallion to a breeding station, you've got those costs associated with it. And there's only, the pie is only so big, so to speak, and your outputs are high. So, you know, from a financial management standpoint, I think, you know, for the average person, if you're interested in going into stallion ownership, I think the biggest thing to realize is that very few stallions are, at the end of the day, all said and done, profitable. you know, after you factor everything else into them. I think that's the kind of first thing to realize is like, for in most scenarios, that stallion is not going to be your retirement plan, so to speak, because by the time all the outputs go out the door, there's, you know, there's just not a ton left over. So if you're going into it, that's fine, but also realize that it's a little bit of a labor of love. I mean, you have to really believe in that horse to make it work.
I would agree with you, Chelsea. It is a labor of love. I think from an amateur owner's perspective, as far as finance-wise and owning a stallion, you got to realize it's not a sprint. It is a long distance. It's a long game. And there is, on the front end of it, a lot of output as far as for putting your stallions into different programs, putting them with different trainers to promote them, all of your advertising costs, and then also just promoting the brand itself. So it's not just about the stallion, it's about the brand. And if you think about people who are branding their product, you know, it's definitely not something that is done overnight. You have to love it, and everyone has to see that you love it. And you got to believe in your own product that you're selling. So I think in the long game, if you do it correctly and you budget correctly and you have a great team that has good communication, I think you can make it work to where it can be a good retirement. And it can, I think it has served Amy Gums and Debbie Truby. Their stallions have served them very well. And it shows for it. They do well with their yearlings, and they do well with all their prospects that they sell. And, you know, you don't look at it as just, it's just the stallion stud fee that's going to make you wealthy. No, it's all of it encompassed is what's important. And you just have to be due diligent and put together the right team to handle the horses that, you know, that you build a product that the community wants to purchase. Does that make sense?
I'd agree with Susie too. It's more about the program you build around that stallion, not necessarily the stud fees in and of itself.
Yeah. But I would just say stallion ownership is a labor of love, and it is exciting and it is heartbreaking, and it can be all of the above. You just have to be due diligent, and you have to treat it like a business. It's not a hobby. You have to go to work every day. You got to show up every day. Yep. And that makes the difference. You just can't let haphazardly own a stallion and throw it in the air and hope that something sticks to the wall. That's not the industry anymore. You know, it is showing up every day, putting together the best team, putting together a budget that you can afford and don't live above your means.
Yeah.
I was just gonna ask on that conversation of the cost of owning and all of the things that you guys output for them. I was kind of deep dive into the trends or what we're seeing with the stud fees now. And I know, you know, with the economy and everything has gone up. So have you guys, you know, had to increase stud fees just to cover the costs, or what does that look like on that end? Or how do you determine what your stud fee is going to be?
So I incur the cost. We incur the cost of inflation. In the, you know, with all of the stallion service programs that are offered, like Premier and NSBA and Super Sires, you know, because my stallions are fairly young and I didn't want to outprice them. I wanted to make them affordable to the average amateur breeder and not be extraordinarily expensive. But how, you know, one day I hope to have a stallion that can warrant a stud fee of $6,000. That would be outstanding. But right now, I think with the way that the economy is, doing an average price for a junior stallion and, you know, $1,500 is very reasonable. And we also offer, you know, discounts for world champion or reserve world champion mares or Congress champion mares or multiple mares. And I think that's very reasonable for a junior stallion that's just getting his feet wet in the industry. I do see the trends of, you know, the stallions and the people are charging more for their breeding fees for the stallions that have been around. But it warrants that. They have either won a lot or have lifetime earnings of their get who who have produced a lot. And, you know, with anything, you either you can buy a BMW or you can buy a Ferrari. And if you could afford the Ferrari, buy the Ferrari.
Yeah, I'm going to agree with Susie there. I think a little bit of what we're seeing, you know, obviously you have your older, really well-established stallions commanding a higher stud fee, and that makes complete sense. I think, you know, where things are a little bit all over the board is where we're putting that introductory stud fee. And I think that's a function of a couple things. One, it's the economy. I mean, it costs everybody more to feed their horse now than it did 6 years ago. So that's certainly a small part of it. I think the bigger part of it is, you know, our industry has a lot of programs, a lot of opportunities, and everybody wants the stallion that they're breeding to be a part of those, and which is great, but it comes at a cost. And that cost has to be distributed somewhere. It's really hard to justify a stud fee less than $1,000 at this point with all the inputs and cost to it. I've seen this phrase thrown, you know, around a lot on Facebook, and they'll say it's just semen, it doesn't cost them anything. You know, and that's like saying, oh, well, the florist is just picking flowers, it doesn't cost them anything. Like, there's a lot of costs that go into being able to get the semen that have to be factored into it. And there's a lot of that behind the scenes that someone wouldn't necessarily think about. But when you're a mare owner and you're kind of, you set your list of requirements and you say they have to be eligible for XYZ, you know, I think you have to be okay with a higher price point. It's just, if I want a higher quality item, I'm probably not going to order it off of Temu or whatever, you know, people are ordering from. I'm going to go to the higher end, I shouldn't say higher end, but the more brick and mortar type place where I know the quality of the item is good. When we kind of talk about that stud fee and where that's at, all those programs cost money, especially for the junior stallions where, yeah, the older, more established ones, they're getting paybacks from those programs. So that helps. But the junior stallions where their bulls are old enough to really get a piece of that prize money, it's not paying for itself yet.
You know what I think is fairly interesting is if you look at the reining horse industry and what Silver Spurs is doing, you know, they have created their own incentive where the mare owner doesn't have to nominate or pay a fee or anything. And if your horse plays at the Derby and it's the highest placing horse, you get a check for $300,000. And I mean, granted, they are standing several stallions, but they're also offering incentives for mare owners to breed those stallions. And they're not having a whole lot of output in regards to nominating their horses to a program or anything like that. They're just directly getting a check when they win something. And that's a really, honestly, that's a really cool idea. And my partners and I and some of our horse trainers that have our horses, we've all been sitting around and thinking about, you know, how do we build the brand for the stallions in Corriball Ranch, you know? And there may be something in the future with Corriball Ranch offering, you know, money in the yearling lunge line that if you place at the premier sires, and I mean, I haven't discussed any of this with Claire or anything. This is just thinking out loud, you know, with my team, maybe offering an incentive that if you buy a Corriball bred horse, then you have the opportunity, the highest placing horse. I don't care if it's first or 14th. If it says Corriball in the papers and you're the highest placing horse, you get 10 grand, you know? So we've just been kicking around kind of cool programs like that. And I think that could change the perspective of mare owners as it don't have to be nominated to, you know, all of these different programs, or they can still be nominated to all these programs, but there's still an opportunity for them to win a bunch of money, you know, provided by that particular ranch. I just think it's kind of cool what Silver Spurs is doing. And I think that could kind of maybe change the way that the industry is going. We're usually about a couple years behind the reining industry in forward thinking as far as maturity wise, but it would be exciting to see something like that happen.
Well, and I think even, you know, Susie and I've had this discussion at length kind of about providing our own incentives. And even for the smaller stallion owner is something, you know, that I've thought about for my personal stallion. It's something along the lines of offering to pay for your stall if you go to one of the world shows with, you know, a willy baby or things like that, just to incentivize getting them out there in the pen. One, because that's another hard part of stallion ownership, is the only way for you to guarantee those babies hit the pen is for you to do it yourself. But you can't, and not for nothing, like not for any reason other than the fact that, you know, you can't control other people's circumstances, what they're able to do, what their plans are, you know, things like that. So not just a way of incentivizing people to breed to your horse, but a way of incentivizing people to show those horses, you know. And the nice thing about kind of creating those own little incentives like that is just, it's something that's affordable and doable on everybody's end. And, you know, I think there's a lot of innovative ways that we can kind of do that. I do think along the lines of those things, you know, we do have to be careful, because I will say I've got some friends that own like barrel stallions, for example. And really, if you're putting those barrel stallions and everything, you know, all the major programs, I mean, a lot of them are looking at over 30 grand a year just in program fees. Unfortunately, with our side of the industry, that wouldn't be sustainable. So I do think it's a fine line between generating opportunities in the industry and pricing people out of it.
I love the initiative to implement new ideas. And, you know, that's awesome. And I think that's what this industry really needs. Because if we just stay the way we've always done things, we're going to die. But maybe this is a good time to bring up, based on what Chelsea just said, is there things that you guys as stallion owners, or maybe stallion owners in general, wish mare owners or amateur owners understood, and any kind of misconceptions? I think Chelsea has brought up several times now the factor that all these maybe stallion auction benefit programs, like, probably reach out to you guys and want donated breedings, which is all for the right reasons. But it's too much, like, not because it's too much for you mentally, but just too much financially for you guys to even justify on your end. And what other things do you guys deal with that maybe the average person doesn't understand?
I think the hard thing there, you know, just to not be discouraged or feel any kind of way if you ask a stallion owner to donate to this program or that program and they say no, don't be discouraged, and please don't hold it against them. The problem is, you know, I can't count, but exceed my hands and my fingers and my toes, the number of programs that I could donate a breeding for year after year. The problem is, you know, even the top stallions in our walk of the industry, I mean, they're breeding 100, maybe the tippy top 120 mares. So if we talk about giving 20 of those breedings away, I mean, even on a stallion like that, that's a significant chunk, much less, you know, one that's booking kind of more in the 20 to 30 mares a year category. So it's not that stallion owners don't want to participate. It just kind of goes back to that the pie is only so big. And I try as much as possible to support the smaller regional program. And nobody likes to say no. Nobody likes to be that, you know, person that says, no, I'm sorry, I can't do it. But sometimes we have to be, like Susie said, at the end of the day, you know, it is a business. It needs to kind of be treated like one. So that's the hardest part. The other thing is everybody likes to deal. And obviously, especially on the junior stallions, you know, we'll offer pretty big incentive to get you to breed those proven mares to your stallion. But it's kind of one of those things where also you have to be respectful of the person's cost as well. Going back again to that phrase, well, the semen's free. It's not. You have to pay the breeding station. You know, generally stallion stations are going to charge a shoot fee per mare. Then you've also got the breeding report fees, which, you know, in and of itself, that's honestly probably your smallest cost, just filing your breeding report. For example, APHA Breeders Trust, we have to pay $100 per mare on the breeding report on top of the whatever it is, $8, $9, $10 a mare for the stallion's babies to be eligible for that. So even if I give you a free breeding, it still costs me directly So that's another thing to keep in mind too, is just, it's just like any other product. I wouldn't go ask, you know, Custom Colors to give me a free show coat. So just being a little bit cognizant of that too, that a free breeding isn't free for us.
I would agree 100% with that. Free breeding is not free for us. But I will say that I am always open to suggestions or ideas. We are amateur owners. And, you know, there may be something new and awesome in a fraternity out west that I don't know about. And I don't want anyone to ever be afraid to ask. I mean, I can look at my budget and say, oh, yeah, you know what? Let's do that. We can fit that in the budget. I think that will be fine. I think if people treat us like this is a business, and just because we say no doesn't mean that we won't do it next year, that we won't try to put it in the budget next year. I think what I would like for mayor owners to understand is just doing the budget. By doing all the programs that we're in, you know, say if we've got $15,000 or $20,000 in programs that we've paid in and nominated for, that's quite a few breedings to make that up before we even make a profit. Just be mindful that we are here, and without the boys and without the girls, you know, we don't have any horses to show. So we're in this together. So if they can always just keep it in mind that we're in this together, it's not one side or the other. It's a team effort to really create great prospects. I think that we can continue to move the industry forward, and togetherness is what's going to make the difference. I think when people get separate and, you know, start thinking that one side is more important than the other, then we lose connection. And I think that's super important for the industry, is to stay connected with each other's side and listen and gain perspective from each other. In that way, we can keep the industry moving forward. I want the mare owners to understand that I know that it costs so much money to breed your mare and to, you know, to get them ready to ultrasound and to flush, and then, you know, for that flush to produce a grade one embryo. And then, you know, you send that embryo off to a recip farm, and then the recip doesn't go well. That's $1,500 down the drain, you know. So know that we understand that as well. I just think if we continue to understand that both sides are expensive, and we have each other's best interest at heart in trying to produce a great show horse, then I think the industry will continue to move forward. I hope that makes sense.
Absolutely. And, you know, I'll chime in on that too. Susie and I were both mare owners long before we were stud owners. So definitely all kind of in that together. And in the same vein of talking about those economics, I think more than anything, you know, and I do think more people are coming to the realization that, no, you're not going to find that really nice Congress World Show level prospect that's nominated for everything for $3,000. It's just not, that's not feasible for anybody to do long term, to be putting those kinds of babies on the ground and selling them for those kinds of prices. So I think also for the mare owners, not having people contact them and basically asking them to give the babies away is all part of it. And that's right in line with what Susie was saying, is kind of, you know, a general recognition that everybody's in this together. Everybody has costs into it, and this, that, and the next. And just kind of being empathetic for each other. I certainly wouldn't ask Susie to sell me, you know, one of her really nice special babies for $2,000. Because I'd be asking her to, like, give me a horse for free plus some. And that's where I think, you know, the industry as a whole, it'll help when we're all more on the same page with that.
And, you know, if sitting down and doing our budget this year, you know, we went through everything as far as from our brood mares through gestation, through the time that the babies are weaned. I mean, financially, each baby, by the time that it's 4 months old, we've got close with all the nomination programs, all the breeding expenses, feeding it, and all that, we have $11,000 in that baby. So, you know, whether it's a Ferrari or it's a Ford Focus, you got 11 grand in that baby before it's weaned. So, you know, that's if you own your stallion and you're not paying a breeding fee outside, if that makes sense. So understand that, you know, the stallion owners get it, you know, especially when they own their own mares and they're breeding their own mares. We get it. We know what the cost is. And so anyway, I mean, I hope that brings some perspective on breeding the stallion and foaling one out and what your cost is. So
it costs a lot of money to get a baby on the ground anymore, from regardless of the stallion or the mare perspective for all of us. But
that's not including the embryo transfer or ICSI or any kind of, you know.
No, that's just old-fashioned.
Yeah, when everything works like it should. For sure. Maybe in your own personal opinions, what are your criteria or considerations for selecting a stallion prospect? Or maybe what made you guys, I know, Susie, the one you bought was a stallion, or the two, I guess, you bought as stallions already, established, semi-established stallions. But Chelsea, did you raise yours? And why did you decide to leave him as a stud? And then Susie, your new one, your allocate stud, what made you leave him as a stallion?
Well, for me, it was kind of an accidental stallion again. I actually stood Willie's sire when I was out in Kansas. Bought his dam. Breeder, I really wanted a filly with minimal white and no bald face. And I got a colt with a lot of white and a bald face. And I was in grad school at the time. I didn't set out with the intention of, oh, I'm going to have my own stallion prospect. But for me, you know, he came out, he hit the ground. He was just so correct. His legs were so correct. And he just had this presence about him. It was extra special. And there's, you know, not like a more scientific way for me to put that. But he just had that presence about him, too. The other thing in terms of raising him, obviously, I was always very consistent with him. And of course, he's going to do normal, annoying baby horse things. And he's definitely going to do annoying baby stallion things. But, you know, the big thing for me was that that horse has never done anything maliciously. He doesn't have a mean or spiteful bone in his body. If he did, he would have not had his testicles for very long. For me, you know, above and beyond anything else, that stallion has to be good-minded. One, from a breeding manager's point of view, I don't want to work with something that's rotten-minded. Yes, they're allowed to come into the breeding shed and act like stallions and, you know, exhibit stallion-like behavior, but within reason, I expect that I'm not going to get my block knocked off when I'm underneath of him. So from that perspective, it also has to be good-minded enough to make it to the show pen. And that's not to say there haven't been good stallions that never made it to the show pen because of an injury or this, that, and the next. But to me, the two biggest priorities is it has to be built correctly. I can guarantee you, if whether it's the mare or the stallion, if you've got one with a wonky leg and it was born that way, you know, and it's club-footed, it's probably going to pass that on. And the other thing is, you know, the brain to do it. Talent, pedigree, all those things come into play. I think another thing is genetic diversity. I do think as breeders in general, we have to be cognizant of what the gene pool is doing. Because I bred and raised Willie without the intention of having a stallion, and then more recently helped with the acquisition of Figured I'm Invited. What drew me to him, he had all the right things. You know, he had the correct confirmation. He had the pedigree. He had the titles. He had the trainability, the brain. And then the icing on the cake for me was, you know, in that instance, I was able to see what he threw in his first crop. And it was all very quality and consistent. And so that's kind of what did it for me on the Figured I'm Invited horse. I think you kind of have to look at all those things. And Susie can expound upon that on the acquiring the stallion. But to me, there has to be something about him that warrants going through all the trouble. To be honest, it's a lot easier to train a gelding and get one shown. They have to have something that the industry's missing, or, you know, some kind of characteristic that sets them apart, whether that's pedigree, confirmation, movement, talent, trainability, something. It can't just be average.
Yeah. So for me, in picking a prospect now, I would think they have to be more than exemplary. With the gene pool that we have right now and the stallions that are available to breed to, it just has to be so outstanding and so different and so exotic to warrant it to keep its balls. We've take, for instance, the Alcalculator stallion. He showed in the Hunter Saddle in his three-year-old year with Scott Jones and did really well. We won some money with him in the novice and won some money at the premier with him. And he's just very exotic when he trots. I mean, you see this thing trot in the pen, you're like, whoa. That's what drew me to him. And then we decided to, you know, move his career forward with the over fences and do the working hunter in her saddle and the driving. So we're just really, you know, excited about his career and what we're doing with him. And the same thing with the Unbridle Your Dreams. You look at him, his conformation is outstanding. He's a great shoulder. He sits up in his wither. He's strung across his top line. And man, you just don't get a bigger hawk than that loping around or carrying around. And I just think that in order to pick a prospect right now, it has to be exemplary. No question about that at all. And exotic, something that just makes people go, whoa, what is that? Because that's you got to have the wow factor, the stand time, you know? So I would just say pick a really good team to help you if you are aspiring to be a stallion owner. And take your time to find the right one. Pedigree-wise, lifetime earnings, the way that the industry is going and moving forward, the horse industry at AQHA, you just need to be very careful in what you pick and choose. And I just say, just choose the right team to help you and guide you for that horse, for that stallion prospect. Don't get in a hurry.
Yeah, definitely don't be in a hurry.
Do you have any other advice for aspiring stallion owners before we wrap up today?
I would say don't be scared. It's a fun and exciting ride. There's nothing like showing a stallion. This is my first time ever in the last 2 years to show a stallion. And it's, as an amateur, it's pretty cool. I would say, you know, again, just take your time, find the right team. Owning a stallion and showing a stallion is, you got to have them in the right program and communication with your horse trainer and what your goals are. You need to communicate them clearly and don't leave anything for a gray area. Keep it as black and white as you possibly can. And I think you could do well with it.
And add to that, you know, I was a mare girly before I had Willie, and I'll say there's nothing quite like having a good stallion. I mean, the confidence that horse will give you, if he was set up with confidence, he'll give you so much confidence in the pen, and that's definitely something, you know, special. The other thing is you got to have thick skin too. A lot of the people that have been doing this for much longer than I have will tell you, you know, that's one of the most important things. Not everyone is going to love your stallion. Everybody's got their opinions, and that's okay. I'll see horses that other people like that I'm like, oh, I'm not crazy about it. And that's okay. And I think that's the hardest thing, because we do put so much love and compassion and energy and resources into these horses that it's easy to take it personal if somebody, you know, if your stallion isn't right for somebody, but they don't like them for this, that, or the other reason. And that's okay. You kind of have to be okay with that and, you know, realize the fact that, yes, we're going to take everything super personal because that's our labor of love, but just coming to terms with that, particularly when a lot of the events in our industry are so subjective. Everybody's going to have different styles and preferences, and that's part of it, not to be taken personally.
You just can't. And then I would also say budget, you know, make sure you're going to plan on purchasing a stallion, that you budget, and that's going to be very important, and treat it like a business, not a hobby. And I think you can be very successful if you do that, for sure.
Yeah, and definitely, you know, like Susie said, a budget, but also a plan and goals too. I'm a very goal-driven person. I'll admit, you know, I'll slack off a little bit if I don't have a goal to work towards. I'm a very like task-oriented person, goal-oriented, what have you. So don't just buy a stallion because you felt like it that day. Buy a stallion because you've been thinking about this. This is what you want to do. This is your ultimate goal. You know, and also I would say in buying a stallion, make sure you're doing it with the intent of putting nice babies on the ground. To me, that always needs to be your first goal. Your goal is not to buy a stallion and breed to however or whatever mares want to or will breed to, and breed to ones that make sense. Breed to ones that you feel like he's going to complement. There have been mare owners before that want to breed, you know, to Willie or whoever. And if I don't feel like it's a good fit, I'll be honest about it. So that's another thing, is make sure your ultimate goal is to put nice babies on the ground and, you know, move the industry forward.
Yeah, I think a positive way to look at stallion ownership is, how can you create a positive impact on the association? What can we do to continue to create forward momentum in the industry for amateur owners, mares, or stallions that show? You know, how do we put a positive spin on that? And that is putting together a good team, putting together nice horses, and offering that to the general public. I think if we look at that, and I think if we look at it in a positive aspect, I think we can continue to move the association, AQHA, forward with being responsible breeders and mare owners.
And another thing, too, just to, you know, continue to add on to that, stallion ownership brings you connections with people that are unlike anything else. I mean, I can't explain how happy I am when somebody texts me at 2 o'clock in the morning to show me their Willy baby. Somebody texts me to show me a video of them doing whatever with their Willy baby, them talking about them, being so excited about them. All that is just a whole nother level of human connection, I think. And even as, you know, and most of us as breeders understand that when the foals that we bred and raised go on to their homes and make their new owners happy and do all that, it kicks it up to a completely different level, too, when it, you know, foals by your stallion. So it's just kind of a little added magic, if you will. And it is so fun in that regard.
I think you both have done an excellent job on demonstrating or talking about just how insanely nuanced owning a stallion and marketing mm-hmm. a stallion and showing a stallion and all the stallion things are for us. So I know it'll be a great listen for our listeners and hopefully provide some information that maybe the average person hasn't thought about before. So we really, really appreciate you deep diving into it with us.
Absolutely. It was a wonderful spending this time with you and giving my perspective and ideas on the industry. I think it's kind of cool. And my door is always open. My email is always open. Any questions or concerns or anything, I'm an open book.
And I would, you know, to add on to that, and Susie talking about her door being open, I will say, I think stallion owners do a really good job of helping each other out. We can ask each other questions. We can bounce things off of one another. Even some of the people that have been in this industry forever, they're so easy to talk to, and they want to support new upcoming stallion owners. They want to help people through that journey. So never be afraid to reach out and just ask questions. We all did at some point. If it's something you're contemplating, reach out to a stallion owner that you know, or even one you don't know, and just have that person to ask those questions to, rather than kind of finding it out the hard way.
If anyone was interested in getting a hold of you or somebody about information about the stallions you own, or maybe stallion owner specific type questions, what's the best way to get in touch with you guys?
You can email me at sp@coralballranch.com, or you can call me on my phone and text me. My number is 919-422-2256. That's always the best way to get me.
Yep. And my email is hassingererc@gmail.com.
Awesome. Well, thank you both again so much for your time and your insight and all your wisdom today. Liz, got anything?
Nope. It was a great conversation, and I'm excited to see what your boys will do this year.
We are too. Thank you for inviting me. It was awesome.
Yes. Thank you. You guys have a great rest of your weekend.
Thanks, ladies.
You bet.
Bye.
All right, that'll be your class. Bring them in and line them up. Bring them in on the rail at a jog, please, on the rail at a jog.